sisters in the Lord Jesus Christ, and especially to our dear young people. We welcome you again around the Scriptures of Truth as we come to consider the life of Jonathan, whose life was wonderful. And we now begin as we lift our voices in praise to our Heavenly Father through the words of Hymn 24. We will consider in this our Brother Roger Lewis's second study, and our Brother Stephen McGeorge shall read for us from the first book of Samuel, chapter 17, verses 55, through to chapter 18, verse 4.
Reading together, brethren and sisters and young people, from the word of Yahweh at chapter 17 of 1 Samuel, commencing at verse 55 through to 18, verse 4. David having just slain that mighty Philistine Goliath. And when Saul saw David go forth against the Philistine, he said unto Abner, the captain of the host, Abner, whose son is this youth? And Abner said, as thy soul liveth, O king, I cannot tell. And the king said, inquire thou whose son the stripling is. And as David returned from the slaughter of the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the head of the Philistine in his hand. And Saul said to him, whose son art thou, thou young man? And David answered, I am the son of thy servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite. And it came to pass, when he had made an end of speaking unto Saul, that the soul of Jonathan was knit with the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. And Saul took him that day, and would let him go no more home to his father's house. Then Jonathan and David made a covenant, because he loved him as his own soul. And Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was upon him, and gave it to David, and his garments, even to his sword, and to his bow, and to his girdle.
We do now look forward, brethren and sisters, to the words of our brother Roger Lewis, as he addresses us to the theme, Jonathan the Friend, Covenant of Friendship and Reconciliation.
Thank you, Brother Chairman, my dear young people, and my dear brothers and sisters in the Lord Jesus Christ. Well, on the occasion of our study last evening, as we introduced ourselves to the character of the man that we're about to consider together, we left him in that wonderful exploit whereby he had climbed the cliff and overthrown the garrison of the Philistines, and we made the point at the conclusion of that study that he had therefore enacted the role and duplicated the feats of Gideon of a previous and earlier time. His own father Saul had sought to model himself on Gideon, but along came Jonathan and fulfilled the same spirit, as it were, without even trying, because he had the same quality that was paramount in Gideon's life. He had humility of spirit, and that was what made him like Gideon. He actually had more faith and more courage than Gideon ever had, but he had the same humility of spirit that allowed him to rest in God's power to accomplish victory, as God did mightily on that day. Saul never had that spirit, never ever found that spirit, never ever saw the secret to Gideon's victory. Jonathan did. And it's that humility of spirit that shines through in the story of Jonathan, and as is going to come out so prominently then this evening in the study that we have before us concerning Jonathan the Friend. And we move forward now in time from the 14th chapter to that story of the 17th chapter, when the house of Israel was faced by the house of the Philistines, and more particularly from the challenge presented to them by Goliath of Gath. And we know the story well of the marvelous victory that David on this occasion accomplished against Goliath when he slew the giant, and Israel as a result were able to pursue after the Philistines and spoil them greatly. And you know, the burning question, when you think about it, that comes out of the 1st of Samuel chapter 17 is not so much the victory of David over Goliath, but the question, why didn't Jonathan face Goliath? If he was the greatest warrior in Israel, why didn't Jonathan go forward and face the giant? In fact, if you come to the 1st of Samuel chapter 17, we're told, of course, in the 16th verse, that the Philistine drew near morning and evening and presented himself 40 days. And for 40 days, Israel waited for somebody to come forward and challenge the giant. Why didn't Jonathan come forward? You might say, well, it was because he didn't want to show up his father, that his father may have been jealous. Maybe that was the case. There certainly was a problem with Saul's increasing suspicion of his son's mighty successes, but I don't think that was the reason. Why didn't Jonathan slay Goliath? Well, I think Brother Islip Collier has the answer in an extract that we have here from his book, The Hand of the Lord, by Islip Collier. And just reading the second two paragraphs there, one may ask, why did not Jonathan, who was so valiant, put all his confidence in God and face the giant? Possibly Jonathan contemplated such a move and asked for a sign from God as on the previous occasion. That's chapter 14. If so, it seems clear that no encouraging sign was given. The narrative evidently means to suggest that it was in the divine providence to introduce David to Israel in this time of crisis. And I believe that Brother Collier is correct in this particular regard. In other words, there was something that deliberately held Jonathan back from facing Goliath. You see, there were two pronouncements that had greatly quickened the interest of Jonathan. If we come back to chapter 13, these two statements no doubt had registered in the heart and the mind of Jonathan. And here they were. In the 1st of Samuel chapter 13 and verse 14, the record says, "But now thy kingdom shall not continue. Yahweh hath sought him a man after his own heart, and Yahweh hath commanded him to be captain over his people." Jonathan heard that, and he also heard chapter 15 and verse 28. Here's the second of the two pronouncements that Jonathan must have thought long and hard upon. In the 1st of Samuel chapter 15 and verse 28, Samuel said unto Saul, "Yahweh hath rent the kingdom of Israel from thee this day, and hath given it to a neighbor of thine that is better than thou." Now Jonathan thought about those two promises from God. And when Goliath came to challenge the nation, we believe, as Brother Collier suggests, that maybe Jonathan in fact did put himself forward and asked for a sign from God that he should face the giant, but there was silence from heaven. Until Jonathan appreciated that maybe it was in the providence of God that the neighbor, better than Saul, should be introduced at this moment to the nation. And so Jonathan stood back. He stood aside. He waited for the introduction of that man for whom now all Israel awaited, the new captain of the people, the new neighbor, better than his father. And for 40 days, he was prepared to do that. For 40 days, imagine the pressure on Jonathan on this occasion. As the whole nation, maybe many people in Israel, urged Jonathan to come forward. No, he says, he wasn't prepared. He believed that the time had come for the neighbor to be introduced. And of course, there wouldn't be anyone in Israel watching for that man with greater interest and greater sensitivity than Jonathan himself. How would you like to be waiting to see the man who God has chosen to displace you from the throne? That's who he was waiting for, wasn't he? The neighbor better than thou. Well, we come back to the 1st of Samuel and chapter 17 and verse 55, and the record tells us, therefore, that when Saul saw David go forth against the Philistine, he said unto Abner, the captain of the host, Abner, whose son is this youth? And Abner said, as thy soul liveth, O king, I cannot tell. Of course, they knew who David was. David had been in the king's court before. But it's a different matter now because, you see, Saul has promised, of course, that whoever slew the giant would have the hand of his daughter in marriage. And it wasn't just so much who's David, but whose father is David. What's the lineage of this boy now that he's about to become the king's son-in-law? And so verse 57 tells us that as David returned from the slaughter of the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the head of the Philistine in his hand. And Saul said to him, whose son art thou, thou young man? And David answered, I am the son of thy servant, Jesse the Bethlehemite. And it came to pass, says chapter 18, verse 1, when he had made an end of speaking unto Saul, that the soul of Jonathan was knit with the soul of David. Jonathan had been waiting for the introduction of this particular person. Now you see, when we read chapter 18 and verse 1, it tells us that when David had made an end of speaking to Saul, that the soul of Jonathan was knit with the soul of David. But the only thing of which it is recorded that David spake is verse 58 when he said, I am the son of thy servant Jesse the Bethlehemite. Now that wouldn't be enough to knit your soul together to another man, would it? So obviously verse 58 of the 17th chapter is but a paraphrase of a much greater speech which must have come from David on this occasion. And we believe that in fact what would have happened was that Saul would have questioned David about the spirit of his actions on that day, and that David would have repeated all the things that he'd said on that day as he recounted before the king why it was that he'd gone out and faced the giant. And here it is. Here are the words that we read concerning the exploit of David on this occasion. He said, of course, for example, in verse 26 of chapter 17, he said, well, to Saul, I felt that these were uncircumcised Philistines and that we should stand against them. In verse 44, the giant had come before David and said, come to me, and I will give thy flesh unto the fowls. Did that frighten David? No, because the record tells us in verses 48 and 49 that far from being frightened, David hasted and ran to meet the Philistine, and the Philistine fell upon his face before David. Such was the confidence that David had in the power of God. In fact, he says in verse 47 here, he will give you into our hands, he cries out to the giant. And again in verse 47, one can imagine David recounting these things to Saul. He says, look, he says, I believe that Yahweh saveth not with sword and spear, for the battle is Yahweh's. And he said, didn't he, in verse 46 of that chapter, that the reason why he'd done this was that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. Now there's the speech of David, as we have the extracts of it recorded for us, in the 1st of Samuel and chapter 17. And chapter 18 verse 1 says, that when Jonathan heard those things, that his soul was knit with the soul of David. And here's why. Because it was Jonathan who'd said in the 1st of Samuel chapter 14, let us go over unto these uncircumcised. It was Jonathan who in chapter 14 had the Philistines say to him, come up to us and we will show you a thing. And had Jonathan been frightened? No, the 1st of Samuel chapter 14 verse 13 says, and Jonathan climbed up upon his hands and upon his feet and they fell before him. It was Jonathan in chapter 14 and verse 10 that said, for Yahweh hath delivered them into our hand. It was Jonathan in chapter 14 and verse 6 who said, there's no restraint to Yahweh to save by many or by few. And it was Jonathan in chapter 14 and verse 12 that said, Yahweh hath delivered them into the hand of Israel. And Jonathan's eyes must have almost popped out as he heard the sound of this young man recounting the exploit in chapter 17. Because what he said was word for word what Jonathan had said in chapter 14. And you know what's interesting about that? Nobody else heard Jonathan's speech, but his armor bearer. David didn't know. Nobody else had heard what Jonathan had said. And yet here was a man that spoke in an identical way and that saw the issues of the truth in an identical spirit. Jonathan couldn't believe the similarity of one who saw the issues of the truth in the same way. And you see what chapter 18, verse 1 says? You've got to read it very carefully. It says, "It came to pass when David had made an end of speaking unto Saul, that the soul of Jonathan was knit with the soul of David." You see what it doesn't say? It doesn't say when David had made an end of slaying Goliath. It says when he'd made an end of speaking unto Saul. It wasn't the action of killing Goliath that convinced Jonathan that he was the neighbor. It was the gracious words that came out of this young man's mouth. Jonathan was impressed with the mind and the attitude of David. That's what bound them together to this young boy. And that's the first principle of true friendship. Like-mindedness. If you want to find true friends, then you must find those that are like-minded in the things of the truth. That's a good lesson, isn't it? They're the only real friends. That's the only basis of true friendship. And it's true for all of us that we need friends, but the friends we need are those who see the issues of the truth in the same way and who have the same feeling about Yahweh and His name and His word and His honour and the same spirit of dedication. It's true for young people as they go about life and as they seek partners and friends of both sexes as they grow up in the truth. Like-mindedness is the basis of all true and proper friendships. Nothing else. If there's no sharing of the spirit of the truth, then it won't last. And this verse, chapter 18 and verse 1, goes on to say that the soul of Jonathan was knit with the soul of David. And the word knit there means to bind together. In fact, it's the same word used in Genesis chapter 44 and verse 30 when it says concerning Jacob and his son Benjamin that his life is bound up with the life of the lamb. Remember that? His life is bound up with the life of the lamb. Genesis 44 verse 30. Same word here. And one of the things that's remarkable about this knitting together in spirit was the tremendous difference in age between these two men. There was a great barrier, as it were, to a friendship developing. Because Jonathan, we believe, at this time was about 40 years of age. David was something less than 20. And he was knit together with his soul. Now you see, it's not just as if the one has said, well, I'm 20 years older than the other. Jonathan could truly say, I'm twice this lad's age. Funny thing of life, isn't it? When you're 20, you think you're grown up. When you're 40, you look at a 20-year-old and say they're just a lad. When you're 60, you think that these 40-year-olds don't know much. When you're 80, you talk about 60-year-olds as being the young people. Well, there was an age difference between these two. Now, you imagine Jonathan as a man in the prime of life at age 40, looking at a 17 or 18-year-old who is just a lad to a 40-year-old and being knit together with him as one. It's a marvelous thing. In fact, you see how the verse finishes? Jonathan loved him as he loved his own soul. You know, Leviticus chapter 19 and verse 18 had said, thou shalt love thy neighbour as thyself. That's what Jonathan's fulfilling, isn't it? This was the neighbour to come. And Jonathan believed that this was he. Thou shalt love thy neighbour as thyself. And Jonathan loved him as his own son. And verse 2 says, Saul took him that day and would let him go no more home to his father's house. We're not told why it was that he was taken to Saul's house. Maybe it was at Saul's own request. Maybe it was Jonathan that had asked that David should be taken into the court of the king. But certainly whoever's decision it was, the one thing we can say is that David's presence in the royal court provided now the opportunity for the friendship between David and Jonathan to ripen. And there's absolutely no doubt, as the record makes clear, that it was Jonathan who initiated and nourished and developed that friendship, and for a very good reason. Because you see, although David may have won a marvellous exploit, he was still only a lad. And whilst he might have been taken to the king's court, he never would have aspired to friendship with the king's son. David never would have dreamed of doing that. It was Jonathan that had to take the initiative in this matter in developing the bond that lay between them, as we believe he did. Because we're told in the third verse, then Jonathan and David made a covenant because he loved him as his own son. They made a covenant, it says. A covenant. Do you know that there are three times where it says that Jonathan and David made a covenant? Here's the first one. Chapter 18, verse 3. Then Jonathan and David made a covenant because he loved them as his own soul. You ought to colour that in. There's the first one. The second one's over the page, two pages over, in the 1st of Samuel chapter 20 and verse 16. The record says there, so Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, let Yahweh even require it at the hand of David's enemies. There's the second covenant made between these two men. In the 1st of Samuel chapter 23 and verse 18, it says, and they too made a covenant before Yahweh, and David abode in the wood, and Jonathan went to his house. Three times these friends make a covenant between themselves. And what we've come up with here in the 18th chapter is the first of those three occasions when this wonderful covenant is to be made between them. And here it is. Here's just the first one that we consider together this evening. And the covenant of chapter 18 established their friendship based upon a mutual reverence for Yahweh and his word. Jonathan acknowledged David's superior right to the throne by spontaneously giving him his royal garments and his princely weapons in sign of his submission and allegiance. And as we go through these covenants, as we come up before them in the record, we'll find how the terms of that covenant are strengthened and strengthened as they bind themselves one to the other in the course of these three marvellous occasions. Have you ever made a covenant with a friend in the truth? Have you ever been that serious about a friendship with someone in the truth that you've made a covenant together as to what you're going to do in the truth and for the truth? That's a pretty serious friendship, isn't it? Who of us have made vows together with our friends concerning the proper serving of Yahweh? And you see how it's Jonathan in chapter 18 and verse 3 who instigates that. Then Jonathan and David made a covenant because he loved him. You see how the record's stated there? It's Jonathan that initiates that, isn't it? Then Jonathan and David made a covenant because he loved him. And from the record that follows, it's going to be clear that the basis of their covenant relationship and of their covenant friendship right from the beginning is Jonathan's acknowledgement of David's superior right to the throne. Now, what a foundation for a friendship between these two men. The man who's just lost the throne and the boy that's only a lad as far as he's concerned, and the basis of the friendship that Jonathan makes with that boy is his superior right to the throne. What a marvellous spirit that was. And you know, I think that it was at that moment of time when that covenant was made that David would have said to Jonathan, you know, Jonathan, I've got a secret to tell you, and nobody else knows this, that Samuel's actually anointed me to be king. No one else did know that, did they? It was David's secret. If anyone else had known, Saul would long ago have rooted David out. And now was the time for that secret to be passed from David to Jonathan concerning the anointing of Samuel back in chapter 16. And then Jonathan would know for sure that this was the one. He already did, but it only confirmed it. And maybe that it was at that time that Jonathan himself would have contemplated earlier promises and suddenly realized that here was a boy who, although only a boy, was of the tribe of Judah. Genesis 49. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, in that Shiloh shall come. Verse 3 says, Jonathan and David made a covenant because he loved him as his own soul. Do you know it's mentioned three times that that's the case? In chapter 18, verse 1 at the end, Jonathan loved him as his own soul. In chapter 18, verse 3, because he loved him as his own soul. And the third time in chapter 20 and verse 17, for he loved him as he loved his own soul. Three times it is recorded that Jonathan loved David as his own soul. It's never ever recorded that David loved Jonathan. We're not saying that he didn't. But the focus is on Jonathan's love for David. Three times that expression is used. He loved him as his own soul. You know, if you come back to Deuteronomy chapter 13 and verse 6, that particular statement is used in the law concerning the tenderest and deepest and most intimate of friendships. We're told in Deuteronomy 13, concerning the counsel of being beware of idolaters, no matter who they might be, Deuteronomy chapter 13 says, and just look at the way the records are couched here. Deuteronomy 13 and verse 6. If thy brother, the son of thy mother, or thy son, or thy daughter, or the wife of thy bosom, or thy friend, which is as thine own soul. If any of those entice thee, go not with them. Now you see the way that the record builds up, and what's the climate? What's considered to be the most intimate of friendships here? Thy friend, which is as thine own soul. And Jonathan loved him as his own soul, says the record three times. Jonathan, my dear brothers and sisters and young people, was absolutely absorbed in this friendship. Absolutely absorbed in this friendship, to the exclusion of himself. And so we come back to the first of Samuel, chapter 18, and verse 4. And we're told there that Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was upon him and gave it to David and his garments, even to his sword and to his bow and to his girdle. Jonathan stripped himself. You see how the whole record here, the whole story of chapter 18 has focused on Jonathan putting himself out to further that friendship. You see verse 1? Jonathan was knit with David. Verse 1 again, Jonathan loved him. Verse 3, Jonathan and David made a covenant. And here now, verse 4, Jonathan stripped himself. It was all of David. All of Jonathan. He put himself out completely to further the cause of David. Absolutely, didn't he? And you see what it says here? He stripped himself of the robe that was upon him. Now, the word for the robe here is used of the ephod, but it's also used of kingly apparel, and no doubt that's what it was on this occasion. It would no doubt be rich in terms of the quality and choice of the fabric. It was a prince's robe. It was a robe that betokened his royal office as the king's son. And he takes it off and he hands it to David. He says, here you are, David. He says, I want you to have this. And then the verse goes on to say that he also gave his garments. And the word garment that's used here is a word that indicates a form of mail that was used by fighting men. It's the same word translated in the 1 Samuel chapter 17 on the other side of the page, verses 38 and 39, as the armour of Saul. Same word translated garment here. Wasn't metal armour in the sense that we understand it, but it was a form of mail that protected them in fighting. In the 2 Samuel chapter 20 and verse 8, it's translated by the interlinear Hebrew as war coat. 2 Samuel 20 verse 8. So he gave him the garment that he used for fighting. And then it says that he also gave him his sword. Anything special about Jonathan's sword? Yes. Because you'll remember back in chapter 13 and verse 22 that only a short time before we're told in the divine record that there were only two swords in the land. Saul's and Jonathan's. There may have been more after the rout of the Philistines, but Jonathan's sword was something special. There was a time when only the king and his son had a sword, and Jonathan takes that sword and gives it to David and says, I want you to have this, David. And then it says that he gave his bow, Jonathan's bow. Do you know that the bow of Jonathan stood as representative of the whole essence of this man? Of course, later on, as we're going to come, God willing, in our concluding study in the 2 Samuel chapter 1, David's going to keep up a lament for Jonathan and call it the Lamentation of the Bow, because the bow was preeminently the weapon of Jonathan, which he wielded in such a masterly way. And he came from a whole tribe, the tribe of Benjamin, that were proficient in the use of the bow, as the 1 Chronicles chapter 12 and verse 2 tells us. That bow stood for the man himself, and he gives it to his friend. And then it says at the end of that verse, and his girdle. You know, military girdles were something rather special. They were finely wrought in leather, and there were precious metals that were then woven into the girdle. And the girdle was used, a military girdle was used, to bind together the upper garments and to provide the place for the sword or the dagger to be housed. And they were regarded in Israel as particularly prized articles. In the 2 Samuel chapter 18 and verse 11, we read on a later occasion that Joab has reports of Absalom hanging in the tree. And he says to the man that saw him, he says, why didn't you kill him? He says, if you'd killed him, he says, I would have given you 10 shekels of silver and a girdle, says Joab. In the 2 Samuel chapter 18 and verse 11, they were prized articles. And no doubt a prince's girdle was particularly precious. Now you see how verse 4 is worded. Let's read it again. It says, Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was upon him and gave it to David, and his garments, even to his sword, and to his bow, and to his girdle. And there's almost a note of wonder and astonishment in the very writing of verse 4 at the extremity of the handing over of those gifts. Enough and more than enough. Wouldn't it have been sufficient to just give him the robe? Wouldn't the robe of Jonathan have been enough to show that he wanted to hand over the royal dignity to his friend? But that wasn't enough for Jonathan. There was a gracious spirit, a generous spirit, a fullness of action here in what Jonathan did. The royal garments and the military robes were Jonathan's way of acknowledging that here was the captain of chapter 13, verse 14, that would lead the nation in the future in their battles. He hands over his military garments. You're the captain to come that will lead the nation. I acknowledge that. And they weren't just presents, were they, brothers and sisters and young people? They were the tokens of the covenant between this couple. And Jonathan, the greatest warrior in Israel, gave David those weapons. Can you see that moment? He unclipped the robe, took his robe off. He says, listen, David, he says, I want you to have this robe. David says, I can't take that. That's your prince's robe. Jonathan says, go on. I want you to have it. David says, well, I'm very honoured that you should give me that. There was no need to. And then Jonathan, all of a sudden, he takes off his coat of mail, his war coat, and he says, I want you to have this as well, David. David says, well, you don't have to give me that. You've already given me the robe. What do you need to give me the war? I want you to have this coat of arms. And David, I want you to have this sword. That, not that sword. That's a special sword that you've had as the king's son. Doesn't matter. I want you to have that sword, David. And my bow. Oh, not your bow. Yes, I want you to have my bow. And while we're about it, I'd like you to have my girdle as well. Can you imagine how David felt? Can you imagine how David felt? As a man 20 years his senior took off everything he could and gave it to him as the basis of their friendship. And you know what Jonathan's saying? He's saying, I want you to understand, David, that the basis of our relationship is founded on your superior right to the throne. And I acknowledge that. And you know what else he'd done? By giving his military equipment as a gift, Jonathan became symbolically defenseless before David. I'm in your power now, he says. I've given you all my weapons. I'm under your control. Philippians chapter 2. Isn't this the Spirit? We're going to read right through from verse 1 to verse 9. We're going to change one or two words as we go. If there be any consolation in David, any comfort of love, any fellowship of the Spirit, any bowels and mercies, fulfill ye my joy, that ye be like-minded, having the same love, being of one accord, of one mind. Let nothing be done through strife or vainglory, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem other better than themselves. Look not every man on his own interest, but every man also on the interest of others. Let this mind be in you, which was also in Jonathan, who being in the form of Saul, thought it not a thing to be grasped at to be equal with Saul, but made himself of no reputation, and took upon him the form of a servant, was made in the likeness of men. And being found in fashion as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even the death of Mount Gilboa. And God has highly exalted David, verse 9, and given him a name which is above every name, that at the name of David every knee should bow. Isn't that the life of Jonathan? And there's a principle here, isn't there? A principle of true friendship. Romans 12, verse 10. Be kindly affectioned one to another with brotherly love, in honour, preferring one another. Ephesians 5, 21. Submitting yourselves one to another in the fear of God. Philippians 2, in lowliness of mind, let each esteem other, verse 3, better than themselves. 1 Peter 5, verse 5. Yea, all of you be subject one to another and be clothed with humility, for God resisteth the proud and giveth grace to the humble. You know, brothers and sisters and young people, there are many in the truth who yearn to have a true friend, but they've never learnt that the secret of friendship is to learn to genuinely esteem the other as better. And there are some people that are never prepared to do that. There are some people in the truth that never, ever do learn to really esteem their brother as better than themselves. And as a result of that, they never do find true friendship. And Jonathan's a type of the disciples. And we've all been invited into a covenant of friendship with the beloved. And the basis of our covenant of friendship with Christ is that we must all acknowledge his superior right to the throne and to esteem him as better than ourselves. But how do we practice esteeming Christ better than ourselves? Unless we practice it to his brethren. Inasmuch as you've done it unto them, you've done it unto me. Jonathan had a wonderful spirit, didn't he? As we come back to the divine record, we move to the 19th chapter, the 1st of Samuel chapter 19. And here in the first few verses of the 19th chapter, we read now of a dreadful time when the first black cloud came looming up over the horizon that was to come between Jonathan and David's special and unique friendship. No doubt Saul was partly aware of Jonathan's friendship with David, but what he didn't realize was the depth and extent of that friendship, and he probably didn't understand at this stage that they had made covenant vows between them. And in the 1st of Samuel chapter 19 and verse 1, the record says, "And Saul spake to Jonathan his son and to all his servants that they should kill David." Now, Jonathan, in turn, may have been aware of Saul's brooding discontent, but he would no doubt be shocked and horrified to find how far his father's feelings had gone. And, of course, Saul would have made it sound all reasonable, wouldn't he? He would have said, well, you see, David's plotting against the throne. There's a great deal of unhappiness in the nation. There is no peace to the kingdom until David is removed. And Saul would have put up some form of convincing argument concerning the necessity for the removal of David. And you know, in chapter 19 and verse 1, there begins now the conflict that is to tear Jonathan's soul apart for the rest of his life. You know, most of us have certain things in life that we have to face as one of the big battles. And here's Jonathan's big problem in life. And it was going to tear his soul apart again and again while he wrestled to find an answer to this problem. And the problem was how to reconcile an implacable hostility between, on the one side, the man he respected as his father, and on the other side, the man whom he loved as his dearest friend. And there was an impossible hostility between those two. Now, how do you reconcile that? How was he to reconcile that problem? And you know what Jonathan's problem was? He says, how can I maintain my loyalty to my father, my support of my friend, and my faithfulness to God? And that's the whole story of his life. Struggling to resolve that problem. How do I maintain my loyalty to my father, my support of my friend, and my faithfulness to God? And you see how all three of those names are bound together in the record here in verse 1. Saul spake to Jonathan about David. And there's this terrible triangle here that's now entered into the record. It's again there in verse 2. But Jonathan, Saul's son, delighted in David. And there are those three names that when they're brought together in the record create this terrible conflict as far as Jonathan is concerned. It says in verse 2, but Jonathan, Saul's son, delighted much in David. You know, the word delighted there means to incline towards
or to desire greatly. The word exceedingly means greatly there. And the word much rather means exceedingly or greatly. He inclined towards David. He felt drawn towards the spirit of that young man. And you know what the problem was with that? That as he felt drawn towards David, he inevitably felt that he was inclining away from his father. And Jonathan's problem was that although he felt himself drifting away from his father and towards David, he always maintained and desired to maintain his outward loyalty to Saul. He never criticized Saul to David in this record, anywhere. He never ever criticized Saul to David. And he never ever let his father down. Now that was a tremendous accomplishment for Jonathan to achieve in his life in view of the pressures that were placed upon him. And so on this occasion he says, Jonathan told David, saying, Saul my father seeketh to kill thee. Now therefore I pray thee, take heed to thyself until the morning, and abide in a secret place, and hide thyself, and I will go out and stand beside my father in the field where thou art. You know, those words in verse 3 are invested with a great significance that even Jonathan himself did not appreciate at this time. I will stand beside my father. Because that's what he ends up doing. And that's exactly what Jonathan finishes like. I will stand beside my father. Oh, he never ever realized how invested with significance those words were. And I'll commune with my father of thee, and what I see, that will I tell thee. This was a very dangerous move for Jonathan himself. It involved risk to his own life. Because you see, if Saul, in his unbalanced state, found that Jonathan now was truly at friends with David, if his plan was thwarted, he might well turn upon his own son. There was risk to Jonathan in this matter, wasn't there? And he was prepared to pledge himself in that wholesome way in order that his friend might be helped. And so verse 4 begins to tell us of the work that Jonathan now had here as he spoke to his father. I can just imagine Jonathan, mouth dry, nerves taut, mind racing, as now he began the delicate task of intercession and of reconciliation. And verse 4 says that Jonathan spake good of David. You know, that's a characteristic of true friendship, isn't it? Speaking good of one another. There are those that talk about friendship and the truth, but they always, or at least some people, have a funny knack of running you down behind your back. True friends don't do that. He spake good of David. You know how easy it would have been for Jonathan to say to his father, now look, I know what David's like. He's getting a bit, you know, he's had a couple of good victories. Why don't we demote him? Perhaps cut him down to size a bit there. And look, you leave it to me. I'll sort it all out and make sure he's put back. How easy it would have been for Jonathan to take some other stand whilst David wasn't there. But he spoke good of David unto Saul. And you know who's speaking good? The man that's speaking good of David here is the one who has the most to lose through the preservation of David's life. He's the one who speaks good. He was totally committed to promoting David's cause. And you see, just look at the tactful way that Jonathan goes about the speech. You see what he says? He says to his father, let not the king sin against his servant. You see Jonathan's choice of words there? You see, that was the whole problem that was eating out Saul, wasn't it? His position of preeminence as the king. He doesn't go up to him and say, listen, Dad. He says, let not the king, that was tactful, wasn't it? Let not the king sin against thy servant, against David. He's only a servant, he says. There was something very wise about the way that Jonathan went about this work. He wasn't just concerned for himself, and he wasn't just concerned for David. He was concerned about his own father's standing before God. And he sought to to couch his words in a way that would appeal to his father that he might listen. Now look what he says. He says, let not the king sin against his servant, against David, because he hath not sinned against thee, and because his works have been to thee with very good. For he did put his life in his hand and slew the Philistine, and Yahweh wrought a great salvation for all Israel. See that phrase there? Yahweh wrought a great salvation for all Israel. Do you know where that comes from? Come and have a look at chapter 11. The 1st of Samuel, chapter 11. And verse 12. And the people said unto Samuel, who is he that said, shall Saul reign over us? Bring the men that we may put them to death. They were men of Belial, chapter 10, verse 27. And Saul said, verse 13, there shall not a man be put to death this day, for today Yahweh hath wrought salvation in Israel. You see what Jonathan did? Oh, this was wise. Do you know what he did? He quoted back to his father Saul's own words from a better, earlier time in his own life. When after a great victory, Saul's gracious and forgiving spirit on that occasion had offered life to men far less deserving of life than David on this occasion. That was a wise move by Jonathan, wasn't it? He reminded Saul of his own words on a better occasion when he'd shown the spirit of forgiveness. Do you remember that, Father, he says? Remember that time? Can't you do it again? Don't you think David's worthy? Very skillful, wasn't it? Back to the 1st of Samuel 19 and verse 5. Jonathan says at the end of that verse, wherefore then wilt thou sin against innocent blood to slay David without cause? Innocent blood. You know that phrase is taken from the cities of refuge. In Deuteronomy chapter 19 verse 10, the cities of refuge were provided to ensure that angry, brutal revenge was not taken by a man hasty in spirit. And it specifically says that the cities of refuge were provided, Deuteronomy 19 verse 10, that innocent blood be not shed, says the Lord. And Jonathan was guarding against that same rash, hasty spirit in his father. And you see what verse 6 says? And Saul hearkened unto the voice of Jonathan. And Saul sware, as Yahweh liveth, he shall not be slain. He was touched and moved by his son's impassioned pleading. And there's a lesson in this. And here's the lesson. Learning tact in the affairs of ecclesial life. Proverbs 16 verses 13 to 15 says, righteous lips are the delight of kings, and they love him that speaketh right. The wrath of a king is as messengers of death, but a wise man will pacify it. In the light of the king's countenance is light, and his favour is as the cloud of the latter rain. Isn't that what Jonathan had done? And to this agrees the words of Josephus when he says, so Saul was pacified with these words, and swore to his son that he would do David no harm, for a righteous discourse proved too hard for the king's anger and fear. Isn't that a good statement? Learning tact. This is a tremendous lesson, not just for young people, but for everybody. And the lesson is this, that so often the way we handle an issue will determine its outcome. We've got to be right in the issues of the truth, not only in the principle, but in the way we go about promoting that principle. You see, Jonathan could have said to his father, "Now look here, Dad, I'm going to have words with you about your attitude to David. You are 100% wrong. He's a mighty warrior, God's worked with him, a great victory has worked with him, and you're right out of line showing hostility to David. And I want you to acknowledge that you're wrong." You think he would have won his father's heart that day? Might have won his father's spear. Is that what Jonathan did? Could Jonathan have said that he was in the right on the issue? Of course he was. But how did he go about handling it? He showed tremendous tact and sensitivity to a man who, in many respects, wasn't worthy of it. But you know why Jonathan did it that way? Because he didn't just want to win a battle of words. He wanted to win his father's heart to David. And therefore he chose the means that would best promote the cause of the truth. You know, I think that's a tremendous lesson in the affairs of ecclesial life. How many times are there in ecclesial life where an issue confronts us, or we're confronted by an issue and people say, "Well, I told the brother, I gave it to him good and proper. I told him where I stand in the truth, and he wouldn't listen to me." Oh, yes? You're the one that's failed. And you failed the truth. Because if you believe that you're right in the principle, you must find the right way that will best advance the cause of the truth so that other ears might hear that principle. And I fear that there are many times in ecclesial life where people adopt a combative and confrontational and aggressive style and imagine that they are standing for the truth. And the fruits show that they're wrong, because they're incessantly plagued with constant woes and problems and conflicts between people, because they have not learned that it's not just the principle. It's the way you approach the application of that principle. Isn't that the story of Jonathan here? He had every right to criticize his father. He showed tremendous tact and sensitivity, and so should we. And verse 7 says, "And Jonathan called David. Jonathan showed him all those things. And Jonathan brought David to Saul. And he was in his presence as in times past." So Jonathan's approach worked, you see, didn't it? You see, he's a man of abounding courage, of deep humility, of great sensitivity when the occasion demands it. He's a wonderful person. And you see how completely that this is described as Jonathan's work in verse 7. You see it? Read it again. "And Jonathan called David, and Jonathan showed him those things, and Jonathan brought David to Saul." It's all Jonathan's work, this work of reconciliation. It belongs to him. And there's a parable in this. Because you see, Saul represents those that are hostile to the beloved. David represents the Christ. Jonathan represents the disciples. And the disciples of the Lord have not only been invited into a covenant of friendship with him, but their work and their role is to seek to reconcile to the beloved all that are hostile to him. That's the work of the disciples, isn't it? Based on the prototype of Jonathan here. It's our role to turn all to the beloved, those that are hostile to him, and to describe to them the work of Christ in the terms of verses 4 and 5, to speak good of Christ, and to point out to others that his works have been very good, verse 5, "For Christ put his life in his hand and slew the giant of the flesh, and Yahweh through him has wrought a great salvation for all the world." That's the role of the disciples. To reconcile all to Christ, 2 Corinthians 5, verse 18, "God hath given to us the ministry of reconciliation. It's all in the life of Jonathan. So what are the lessons then that we learn from the story of Jonathan this night? Jonathan the friend. We learn that the first principle of true friendship is like-mindedness in the truth. And the disciples have been invited into a covenant friendship with the beloved. We'll never sustain that friendship, my dear brothers and sisters and young people, unless we constantly strive to know the mind of the beloved. Deepest friendship is based upon a genuine and unreserved esteem for one another. Jonathan marvelously showed this spirit in stripping off his royal symbols of rank and dignity. Divine principles must be upheld with tact and sensitivity to ensure that the cause of the truth is genuinely advanced. The work of the disciples is to seek to reconcile those opposed to Messiah before he ascends the throne. These are the lessons, or at least some of them, from that notable and wonderful occasion when Jonathan became Jonathan the friend, offering covenant friendship to his beloved friend and seeking his good in that spirit of reconciliation.